Best Leaves Clues podcast with Robin Bailey and Al McDonald. Have you ever wondered what makes someone successful? What are they doing that's different? How do they achieve greatness? We believe that success leaves clues. In this series, we are interviewing very successful people from different walks of life to hear their stories. We'd like to remind our listeners that the views expressed in this podcast are those of our guests and not necessarily those shared by our hosts. Today's episode is sponsored by Life and Legacy Advisory Group. Discover our commitment to our clients. At Life and Legacy, building wealth, securing your family's future, giving back, and creating a lasting legacy are not just values, but a way of life. Let us guide you toward a future aligned with what matters most to you. We're also brought to you by Aria Benefits. If you're a business leader challenged with talent attraction, employee engagement, or supporting mental health, we can help. Use your benefits package as the key to unlock your workforce. Now here's your hosts, Robin Bailey and Al McDonald.
All right, welcome back to the Success Leaves Clues podcast. I'm your host, Robin Bailey. Once again, joining me is my co-host, Al McDonald. Al, how's your day going?
Going really well. Looking forward again, obviously, to some great guests today, and really interested in our guests that we're about to interview today, because it's something we haven't really talked about before on this, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Out of 218 episodes, yeah, you're right. This is the first time we've broached this subject, so I think a lot of people are going to be very interested to hear what our guest has to say. So,
yeah, I know I am.
Yes, for sure. So joining us today is John Schell, Chair of Social Capital Partners, who I will now refer to as SCP. They are a nonprofit focused on building a more resilient economy through broad-based ownership and quality employment. John has been a leading advocate for employee ownership trusts in Canada and played a key role in financing the sale of Taylor Guitar to its 1,400 employees. John also co-founded the Canadian Employee Ownership Coalition and saved small business during the COVID-19 pandemic. Before joining SCP, he co-founded a major veterinary service providers in Canada and Australia. John, welcome to the show.
Yeah, nice to be here. Nice to see you guys.
Well, before we get started, got to give a big shout out to our friend Rob Drynan for this introduction. And I still haven't stopped hearing from Al what great events Rob throws, his cocktail parties, and just brings really good people together. Hopefully I get to go to the next one because, again, Al just keeps telling me how great these events are. So, Rob, big shout out to you. I look forward to the next one.
Well, and we should mention that it's nice that Rob invited me to talk to you guys on this podcast. He's yet to invite me to a cocktail party. So,
oh, well. Interesting.
See, I see where I live in the Rob Drynan world.
You know what? We'll put in a good word for you.
Thank you.
Well, apparently Al is in that world now, so maybe we can get invited because of Al. But I really want to dive into this because we had a really good first conversation, you know, before we started recording. So I just want to dive in your history. You've spent over 25 years in the private sector. Now you're an investor focusing much of your time on public policy. What caused that? What was the inspiration?
My time in the private sector was fascinating. A lot of interesting roles there. The last one I did was this buying of veterinary practices, which I did in Canada and in Australia. And the path of that sector has been fascinating, right? Like for many, many years, decades, it was quite a simple industry where a veterinarian would sell their business to another veterinarian when they were finished. And when we started in that business back in 2006, that's the way it worked. We would buy businesses from owners who had nobody to sell it to. That was the role we played. But as time went on and large-scale finance got more and more interested in the veterinary industry, it changed dramatically, whereby you had private equity invested in the industry, funded by pension funds, and suddenly veterinarians were not selling to veterinarians anymore. They were selling to people like me for prices that were out of the realm for regular vets. And it was just an interesting time of reflection for me on the industry that we had helped change, and I wasn't super proud of what had happened there. Like the industry, I don't think is better off for our engagement. And, you know, just how capital works and how large scale capital had kind of shifted outcomes in a pretty sleepy industry, right? In a place where the service to clients wasn't better, the technology wasn't better, the lives of the workers, like there's nothing about the industry that's better for the intervention of scale capital. So, what does that mean, right? And for me, it was, okay, what does this mean? What does it mean about where the economy is going? Is that the economy we really want, right? What is the economy we really want? What should it look like? I don't have a big background in public policy. I'm not a policy wonk by any stretch, But I thought maybe I could contribute, because of the things I had seen, to helping to think about what the economy could look like that's still capitalist, still market-based, still free and fair, actually sort of more free and fair, I should say, than it is today. And how do we get there? And public policy is the path, right? You can't get there through people choosing to be different, right? The only way to actually achieve change is through public policy.
You said something really interesting there about, you know, maybe you weren't super proud of and didn't feel good about. And when I talked, because I talked to so many entrepreneurs, whether it's on the podcast or outside of the podcast, and some of them are, you really get the feeling it's capitalism at all costs, no matter what. But is there a place for capitalism and still feeling good about what you're doing and what you're contributing?
Absolutely. There's nothing wrong with capitalism, right? Every capitalist system is guided in some way by the policies that shape it. And the policies that shape it are government regulations and, you know, citizens and democracy and all of those things. And so we have 100 capitalist countries around the world who all operate somewhat differently. You know, in Canada, each province operates capitalism somewhat differently. So what does that mean? How do you choose? And to give an example, I mean, Don, just you mentioned our helping to finance Taylor Guitars. Taylor Guitars is one of the largest manufacturers of acoustic guitars in the world. Wonderful company run by a couple of hippies, right, who had this guitar store in the 70s. And one of the guys, Bob Taylor, realized he was amazing at making acoustic guitars. And the other guy, Kurt Litzig, was amazing at, you know, making sure they made money from making guitars. And it took them forever, but they found a niche and then grew and grew and grew until it wasn't a niche anymore. It was this major player in the music industry. And then they're, you know, 65. What do you do? Right. And the common story is to sell to private equity or sell to a competitor and you cash out and great, big win. But they didn't want to do that. They had seen the impact of private equity on other guitar manufacturers, on others in the music industry, and they just didn't want that set of incentives to drive their business. And so they chose another path, right? So we and a pension fund, we a tiny bit, and a pension fund a lot, an Ontario-based pension fund, Healthcare Ontario Pension Fund, financed their sale to an ESOP, which is an employee ownership program that only exists in America. Spectacular program that's created great wealth. And so then they sold the company essentially to their workers and they feel amazing about it. These are capitalists, right? They were hippies, but they are now capitalists, right? Very much so. But they feel wonderful about what they've done. So can you do it? Yeah, totally.
So John, you're kind of creating a great segue into what I want to talk about next and ask you about, because you've talked about obviously the guitar company and what you did with the veterinary space. So I know that you've been working a lot more closely now on employee ownership, which good for us ties a little bit into employee benefits, something that is likely to resonate with our audience. But can you share a little bit more about what that employee ownership entails and why it's so important and how it does tie into what you talked about with public policy as well?
I will, for sure. But first on the vet thing, before we leave it, because it's interesting, right? Or at least I think it's interesting and hopefully other people too. Our company in Canada was a great company. Like, it wasn't staffed with bad people. I think we hired good people. My business partner is a great guy who is very thoughtful. The issue is, and the issue became, is when you consolidate a bunch of businesses in the sector, eventually it becomes owned by somebody you'd rather not own it.
Right.
There's no path outside of that. And so despite the fact that I think, you know, mostly my business partner, because I left relatively early, he built a great company with great people, eventually it goes in a different direction. And there's almost no way to get off that path unless you find a way like employee ownership to permanently get off that path. So there, I kind of segued myself into employee ownership.
Right.
So a few years ago, we were involved very much in the U.S. ESOP world because it exists. And just to be clear about that, it's a program that was brought in the mid 70s in the US with the objective of making it easier for owners to sell to their workers. It's a registered retirement plan. I won't get into the complexity of it, but over the 50 years it's existed, it's produced incredible outcomes. And today there are over 6,500 employee owned businesses in the US where 14 million Americans share in over $2 trillion in company wealth, right? It's an average of $140,000. Per person. And there are examples like Publix, the groceries chain in Florida that I think lots of Canadians will know because we go there all the time. Bob's Red Mill, which, you know, is on the shelves at your local grocery oligopolist. There's a company called Amstead, which has produced 2,600 millionaires out of shop floor workers. So unbelievable outcomes of this thing. But in Canada, we didn't have anything similar. So we were involved in the US trying to help build even more ESOPs down there or finance more ESOPs. And then we learned that the UK had put in a program in 2014. And so we thought, okay, I mean, this is a pretty interesting thing that we don't have here in Canada. that's proven in the US that now exists in the UK and is thriving in the UK. How do we bring that to Canada? And that program started in October 2020, height of the pandemic. We didn't know whether it was like the best time or the worst time to bring in something like this. But over the last 4 years, the Canadian federal government has been very supportive of efforts and has really pushed this. I mean, it's their policy, right? So we've advocated for it, but the federal Liberals have brought in this employee ownership trust. And do you want to talk about the way it works, or am I going on for too long?
No, I would love to, because I was thinking about this going into today's recording, and I thought my first conversation with you was, this was the first time I'd really started to dive into it. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of listeners who are saying, okay, this is interesting. I've never really explored this.
The theory behind it. And
yeah, maybe that's a great spot to talk about EOTs or employee ownership trusts. I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. So I'll tell a brief side story again, because I think it's interesting. Who knows? But there's the guy in the US who started this was a guy called Louis Kelso. He was a lawyer in California in the 50s and 60s, and he wrote a book called The Capitalist Manifesto. Okay. So his theory at the time was America's going to be communist unless we find a way to share the wealth. Right. So he's a capitalist. There's no, you know, he founded a private equity company. Like, he's absolutely a capitalist. He said, our capitalist project here in the US is going to die if we don't find a way to share the wealth. And that was the idea behind employee ownership. We need owners to have a different way to sell their business now that they're getting to the age where they're thinking about selling. So that's the purpose of this thing. It's, you know, I'm an owner. I've got to sell my business to someone. I would like some different path. Okay. So it's a succession idea. It's not a stock options or share purchase plan, any of those things. It is a succession idea. You have to sell your business. So the way the EOT works is an owner says, okay, I got this business. Say it's worth $10 million. And that's the fair market value. What I'm going to do is I am going to loan this trust $10 million to buy the business from me. Right. And then the business, as the business produces cash in the future, they're going to pay me out my $10 million. Once I'm paid out, or, you know, once I sell it, really, that trust now owns the share. The trust owns the shares on behalf of all of the employees of the company who don't have to put any money in, because me as the owner, I've lent that money to the company, right? So I am financing essentially a big vendor take back, mm-hmm. right? Or big seller note for the purchase of the company by this trust. And the reason why it works, there's two reasons why it works. One, it's indirect. So it's not like the employees go to work every day and have to vote on whether to buy a new machine or to change the hours. The company continues to be run in the same way it always did. The employees are beneficiaries of the trust, but the trust governed by a trustee, they are the ones who vote the shares, right? There's a trustee in place, there's a board of directors in place, and the trustee votes the shares with the best interests of the employees at heart, but they're not making like management decisions. There's still a management team. So the indirect nature of it allows it to be more palatable for businesses that have been run in a hierarchical way, like most businesses are. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is a tax incentive. So the issue for the owner is the company has to succeed. It's way more risk than just selling it to somebody else. I'm not getting my cash up front. This is risky for me. Why would I do this? Well, governments in the US and governments in the UK, and now the government of Canada, has said the outcomes of employee ownership are so good that we're willing to give you a tax incentive to do this. And so in Canada, the first $10 million of capital gains when you sell to an EOT are tax-free. So that accounts for the fact that I have to stay connected to the business longer. I'm not getting my cash up front. It's a little higher risk. I get a tax benefit for that. So that's essentially how the EOT works. And, you know, we're excited to see what happens here in Canada.
John, what have you seen so far? Because this is obviously something that's fairly new in Canada. What have you seen the uptake, if you will, on this? Like, how have people responded? Are people embracing this, or is it still something totally new and unknown? What's your experience been?
It is both totally new and unknown. The law came into place June 21st, 2024. So it's been like 4 or 5 months. So there have been no deals yet, but it's impossible to sell a business in 4 months. So that it's not a surprise. Mm-hmm. I understand that I think the first deal will happen end of this year, so December 31st or Jan 1, and there's a number of deals in the pipeline. So someone has set up like an advisory firm to help companies do this. I know her pipeline is full. I've had a lot of outreach from owners who are exploring it, but it'll take some time and we have to be patient with it, right? So in the UK, in the first year after they brought in their EOT, there were, I think, 15 or 16 companies that sold to EOTs. The next year was 25, then 30. By year 5, it was 150. And we just heard a couple of days ago, the new stat came out saying that 8% of all transactions in the UK in the last year have been sold to an employee ownership trust, which is about 400 businesses. So it takes time for the advisory community to understand it. The government may need to make a few tweaks to, you know, here and there in case there are things that are misunderstood. But I think I would be surprised if there weren't 20 deals done next year in 2025, which would put us on a great path, a great trajectory.
And do you think, is there a sweet spot where you think this is really, really appropriate for, you know, the type of company or the size of company? Or is this something that could apply to any company, any industry, any size?
Look, it can apply, but there is a sweet spot. There's no question there is. And it's the reason why, while 8% of businesses sell to EOTs in the UK, 92% don't, right? So it will always be a sort of a niche. Generally speaking, these are mature companies in mature industries with stable cash flow that don't require substantial reinvestment of capital over time, so they can afford to pay out the debt, where the management transition is either complete or there's a path to a thoughtful management transition. Size is usually between 25 and 200. The top five industries in both the US and the UK are, we'll see if I can get all these five right, construction, professional services, wholesale, distribution, and light manufacturing. Mm. Those tend to be the primary industries for this. But construction is a huge industry here in Canada, right? Those companies tend to be hard to sell, but very profitable, good cash flow, perfect candidate for an EOT.
John, your advocacy for employee ownership trusts has been quite successful. Obviously, you know, speaking to you twice now and hearing about where this has come from and where it's going, what do you think contributed to that success?
Well, look, there were a lot of people involved in this, and I think that was pretty important. Back in 2022, we launched something called the Canadian Employee Ownership Coalition, which brought together almost 100 leaders from across the country who were passionate about this topic, and folks from the Bank of Montreal and Friesen's, an employee-owned company in Manitoba, and others who really cared about this. I think for the government, they saw this as something that lots of people cared about. And it wasn't just business community. It was like nonprofit, academic, charitable. People think this is a good idea. So for anyone interested in public policy, it is really helpful when other countries have done it first, right? Especially here in Canada. We really like ideas that other people have proven. And the nice thing about this one is that was certainly true. And this policy also had something going for it that very few policies do. It appeals to everyone on the political spectrum. Right. So we're talking about workers and broadening access to wealth for people who otherwise don't have access. And it's important to say here on that topic, because employees don't pay for their shares and because all employees are beneficiaries of the EOT, it is like a very unusual tool, right? In that it really broadens wealth and makes it accessible to people. A lot of these programs, you have to pay for your shares, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But lots of people don't have capital sitting around to buy shares. And so it ends up being distributed only to a certain group. This is not like that, which is wonderful. So that's that appeal. It also keeps jobs in local communities and keeps companies Canadian owned. And you can imagine the kinds of people who are super excited about that part of it. It is proven to be productivity enhancing, right? So employee owned companies tend to be more productive. They grow faster. There's a big constituency for that. And to me, the most interesting thing about it that's come out of the study of employee ownership, mostly from the US, is how great they perform in recessions, right? So when you shift the incentives of the owners of a company from folks who are worried about, I'm going to sell this in 2 years to somebody else, so I need to make sure my EBITDA doesn't go down one iota, to where the shareholders are workers, where the incentives are just completely different. When the recession hits, the incentives on what you do completely changes. So if my incentives are for the shareholders that are employees, I'm going to think about preserving jobs during the recession, knowing that eventually the recession will be over, right? And we'll come out that much stronger. And all of the evidence suggests employee-owned companies lay off fewer people in recessions. They're just willing to eat the cash for a short period of time and are much stronger coming out of recessions, which is great for the economy, right? So there's just so many facets to employee ownership that are proven to have benefits for the economy and for working people and for business owners and for succession, that broad appeal really helped when it came to talking to folks about this in Ottawa.
Even as I'm thinking about it from my perspective in employee benefits, one of the things that I hear continuously, we've got these great companies that we're dealing with, you know, we're setting up their benefit plans. But we always hear about how do we attract and retain good quality employees. And I'm just thinking as you speak, if I'm one of these employees involved in one of these situations, well, there's my attraction piece gone. Like, where else am I going to go where I have this opportunity? Like, you are never going to get more loyal, hardworking people who are willing to stick with the company, to your point. So, I mean, I think this is such a fantastic idea. And I know it's early on, as you said. And I'm really, John, I'm really excited to see where this goes, because I think this is going to be such an interesting thing to watch, because I think this is going to be exciting for a lot of people. And to your point, giving people the opportunity to create that wealth that maybe wouldn't necessarily have that option. So I think this is fantastic.
Yeah. And look, I mean, so two things. One, there's a great example. I talked about Friesens before. Friesens is a printing company. So there's two companies that do the yearbooks in Canada. There's Friesens and Jostens, right? I don't know which did yours, but Friesens might have been the one. And they do a lot of other things too. But anyway, they're a 600-person company in Altona, Manitoba, which is a town of 4,000 people north of the U.S. border. And that company became employee-owned about 60 years ago. They operate like an employee ownership trust, even though those regulations didn't exist before. They kind of just made it work. Last year, that company paid out $5 million in dividends to their 600 employees, right? So if you're there, you're making 50 grand a year or whatever, and you get a check for $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, it just changes your life, right? There's just a massive, and if that's the market value for your, you know, if you go somewhere else, you're going to make 50 grand, but you don't get that extra $10,000 bonus. It's an amazing impact on your life. And look, I think those who have accumulated wealth almost always have done it through asset ownership, right? You can't salary your way to wealth, right? And asset ownership, company ownership is exclusive in its distribution, right? And more exclusive every day. So this is a way to say that's not the way the economy needs to work, right? There are mechanisms, if we are thoughtful about it, to distribute that driver of wealth to more people who deserve it just as much as those who were born into a path to it that others don't have access to. And so we're super excited to see how this plays out here in Canada.
John, I'm going to make an assumption. And if my assumption's wrong, you can correct me. I'm going to assume that in a lot of cases, as the current owners, there would be a bias to that's too much risk. My team won't be able to run the company. I will lose my money. This is a dumb idea. Whereas you've painted a great picture. So my assumption is there is that bias in place in a lot of cases. If that's true, how do you overcome it?
This isn't for everybody, right? I don't think you can overcome it. I think there are some people who will look at this and say, no, I want the best possible price and I want out. And I'm worried about all the things you said. That's okay, right? We don't expect everyone to do this. But we know from the US and the UK that there is a subset of owners who will. The owners in Canada are not different, right? The Canadians are not different from, you know, the British people are not different from Americans. We're the same. And we have the same distribution of companies and we have the same distribution of demographics of ownership. Like, it's the same. So, I expect if we do really well, 6 to 8% of transactions in Canada over time will sell to employee ownership trusts. And that's great. That's a huge number. It would mean something like 20,000 Canadians became owners of their companies every year, right? Each public policy initiative is not going to solve every problem. But there are companies where it also is a bad idea. You know, you're a tech company and you need lots of investment. You don't have much cash flow. Bad idea. Maybe your culture is bad, right? You've been running this thing for a while. You've been grinding folks down. Maybe you have good reasons for it. I don't know. But that's not the right answer either. So like I say, there's like a subset of companies for whom this is suitable. And there's a subset of owners who will get excited about this. It's the owners who are in maybe smaller towns where everyone goes to the same grocery store and they see each other every day and they want to have their head held up high when they walk through that place and they didn't sell it to somebody who's going to move the jobs somewhere else. Those people exist and they're probably listening right now. And for them, this might be the best possible answer.
Well, I hope they are listening right now.
Me too.
Okay, so beyond employee ownership, we'll switch gears a little bit. Are there any other public policy issues that you're particularly passionate about or curious to explore?
We've been pretty involved in the antitrust movement here in Canada, which was the sort of anti-monopoly. Like, how do we shift our economy away from being super concentrated in a few hands? I mean, the obvious ones everyone knows, the grocery, the telecom, the banks, etc. But it's throughout the economy. I heard the other day that there's these, you know, the ND or whatever, these mattress, Casper, the mattress manufacturers, or you just, apparently they're all owned by Sleep Country. right? There's a little bar that I like to go to in Toronto called the Velvet Underground. It's been there forever. They get a little dive bar. It's owned by Live Nation, right? So it's mind-blowing, like the depths to which these tentacles go. And there's a real energy in Canada around, okay, enough is enough, right? So I've been really interested in that. And, you know, I think there's other things. There are ways in which we think about the economy that are just wrong. And I'll give you one example. It's probably boring your audience to tears here, but in every budget, the Minister of Finance will say, look how much foreign direct investment came into Canada. We're doing great on foreign direct investment. And they never specify what that actually means. And the vast majority of foreign direct investment is someone from another country buying our stuff, right? Not bringing in capital to build a factory. Like when you walk down the street and you say, hey, we just had, you know, South Korea just spent $1 billion in Canada. Isn't that great? Their minds would go to a factory that was built, right? It's almost never a factory being built. It's almost always someone buying a company that exists and then sending profit somewhere else with either no change or a negative change to the company, right? So we just don't talk about things the right way. Do we want people to invest in this country when they're building a factory or when they're building a new research hub? 100%. Do we want them to buy Inco and Stelco and whatever? No. We don't. So I think these are the kinds of things where we just have the wrong frame when we think about the economy and what we want that to look like. And those are the areas that I'm really interested in.
Oh, you paused there, Al. Are you getting ready for your signature question? Is that why you paused there for a second?
Yeah, I didn't know if you were going to hop in there or not, but yeah, I'm ready to go if you are.
Well, yes, of course. And, you know, as I'm listening to John speak to me, he's already answered the question, but you never know. There might be something else.
But you never know.
Exactly. He might want to add something else. Who knows?
Someone who's as passionate as this might have something else on the back burner.
I'm really worried about what's coming next.
Well, John, don't worry. It's a great question. As I said, I think you've already been answering it the entire podcast, but let's see if you have something else. So Al, take it away.
Yes. So here's how we'll end off, John. A society grows great when old persons plant trees in whose shade they will never sit.
Mm.
So can you talk about any proverbial trees that you might be planting? And it might be professional, might be personal.
Boy, I mean, I do think we have talked about this. I think that we are spending, so I think as a economy, we're spending a lot of time cutting down some trees. And so I am actually, to be honest, less worried about planting new trees than saving the trees that exist.
Interesting.
I think we are slowly letting large-scale finance cut down the trees that would otherwise have shaded. Like if you're a young person, you can't buy a house, you are not going to have a defined benefit plan, like pension plan. Your wages may go up slightly, but it's going to be consumed by rent that's going up. And I meet so many young Canadians, and when I say young, I mean like sometimes 38-year-old folks in Toronto who are planning their exit and not sure how they're going to get work because scale finance is also saying you got to return to the office, right? So we have this like horrible moment, I think, and this is, you know, I'm going to be a bit extreme here, but where the price of housing has gone up. We had one possible answer that had revealed itself to us during COVID, which is work from home, right? Where you could potentially move to a place you could afford and still have a good job. And those who put their fingers on the scale of the system are saying, no, come back to the office because I'm also invested in this office building next door. So I care about that. And so we're cutting off every path. And to me, that's the cutting down of these trees. So we need to save the trees that will allow people to buy homes, to live good lives, to have pensions. And that means some other people may need to have less wood for their fireplace, but I think that's okay.
That's interesting. That's an interesting take on that question that no one has said before. But you're right, as important as planting new trees, preserve the old ones. So I applaud that. A new take on that question.
Well, there you go.
That's why I love that question, because again, yeah, very unique response to that. So John, for listeners who want to find out more about you or what you're doing, what's the best way to reach out?
I think most of the people who are listening to this are probably here for the employee ownership. So I would say employee-ownership.ca is a website that has a bunch of information on this that will cover stuff that I definitely not covered here. And I am on LinkedIn. I can be an irritating follow because I have opinions from time to time that you won't like. But I'm there. So, we're happy to engage.
Perfect. Well, that does it for today's episode. I think you can tell we really enjoyed this conversation. As always, we hope you did too. If you have any questions for Al or myself, please feel free to give us a call or by joining the conversation on LinkedIn. We've seen it here clearly today. Success leaves clues, my friends. We'll see you next time.